Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Today, it's Yolele. In Senegalese, it means let the good times roll. Here, it's the title of a new cookbook by Chef Pierre Cham. We know next to nothing about African food traditions. This chef brings us the foods, the culture, and the people of his home country of Senegal. Tea man Bill Waddington translates tea lingo, as in what those letters after a tea's name mean. For example, F-T-G-F-O-P. New York City food guy Mike Colomeco talks red sauce restaurants. Southern Italian places are finally getting their place in the sun. And then we talk your car engine as slow cooker, as in manifold destiny. Just bring a lot of foil and leave home the Porsche. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. Hey, Jane, Michael, have you guys gotten back to what I think of as the food mecca of the West, Portland, Oregon, by any chance?
Oh, yeah. It is a food mecca for all kinds of things. And, you know, for us, it's also a coffee mecca. I mean, Seattle is great for coffee, too. Don't get me wrong. Portland coffee is every bit as good. And in addition to coffee, one of the great hot beverages to be drunk in Portland is hot chocolate. And the place to get it is a chocolate shop called Sahagun, with a little accent on the last U. Mm-hmm. And this, let me tell you, it's nothing like hot chocolate that you'd get in a diner, for example. I mean, it's all made from, you know, hormone-free, organic milk, et cetera, but who cares? I mean, what's great about it is just how intensely, intensely cocoa-y it is. And I don't mean like super sweet, because it really isn't that sweet. It's like richly, richly essence of chocolate. I mean, it's almost like it's like a drug, you know? I mean, it's like it feels too good. I mean, there's something illicit about it. I mean, it's that good.
But it is legal. You know, Lynn, I know you and Michael and I are all about the same age. And, I mean, my memory of hot chocolate growing up was, you know, a tablespoon of Nestle's Quick put into hot-ish water and stirred around so there were like lumps floating on the top of it. Mm. Well, baby, we have come a long way in hot chocolate drinking since those rather pathetic days.
Where is this place? Is it in the center of town?
It's on West 16th Avenue.
Northwest 16th.
Northwest 16th.
It's not far. The thing that's cool about it is that it's very inconspicuous. I mean, there's no big sign. There's a tiny sign in the window that says chocolate, and that's all. And it is a chocolate store, and you can get all kinds of, you know, single origin chocolates and, you know, chocolate covered Meyer lemon peels and stuff that's really great. But it's not a restaurant at all. I mean, you can just simply sit down at the bar and have either a coffee or a hot chocolate or a combination of the two.
Oh, they do hot chocolate with coffee, like a true mocha.
Of course they do. This is Portland.
Now, Michael, you kept talking about a bullseye of cream in the chocolate. Maybe I was slurping it too fast to remember that.
Well, somehow the way it's mixed, I mean, the cocoa is mixed with milk and half and half. And somehow, some way in the process, the center of the cup has like kind of a whitish, sort of a swirling bullseye of thick cream at the very, very top. And that would be a little too contrasty to the chocolate. So it is offset by a sprinkle of chocolate flakes that cover the cream.
I never noticed any of this.
Well, you were just too busy drinking.
I swear to God, I didn't notice bullseyes and flakes and all the other things.
More reason to go to Portland. High more art yes. in a cocoa yes. cup. I love it.
Exactly.
Thanks, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
And that's good enough reason to live. Good enough reason to live. If I die young, at least I got some chocolate on my tongue. If I die young, at least I got some chocolate on my tongue.
One of Jane and Michael Stern's life-changing tomes is Chew for the Road. Now, you know that you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you don't have to wait days to get their food finds. Just check them out anytime on the website, splendidtable.org. Last night, I had what I would call a moment. I had picked up carrots, kohlrabi, onions, and something I'd never seen before, a yellow turnip. And I decided that I was going to make sort of a mashed root vegetable thing. So I thin-sliced them all, threw in the onion, boiled them in some salted water. And while they were boiling, I filmed a skillet with olive oil, chopped up about, I don't know, 6 garlic cloves, threw in some thyme and black pepper and some water so that I could kind of stew the garlic cloves and not worry about them burning. Well, the vegetables were done in like 10 minutes, and they were really soft. I wanted them almost melting. I lifted them out of the pot. I saved the water, dropped them in that skillet, and then I just let them wait until we were ready for dinner. I mixed the whole thing up, and the fact was they looked so pretty, the yellow and the orange and the white, that I didn't bother mashing them. They were like eating the sweetest, most delicious thing swimming in butter, and they weren't. And the bonus is I've now got this really nice tasting vegetable water and I can use it as a broth. I can throw a little bit of ham into it and some greens. I could add a little cheese or I could use it as a base for, you know, a more complicated soup. So try a variety of root vegetables. You just boil them quick, drop them in some flavored oil and you're home free. Waddington is one of my favorite tea authorities. He loves the subject to the point that he practically lives it. And he's constantly finding tea growers and tasting teas at their source. Now, Bill is creator of the Tea Source Shops in Minnesota. Bill, it's good to have you back.
It's great to be back here, Lynn.
You know, when you buy high-quality teas, you'll run into teas where you'll have a name and then you'll have a string of letters.
Yeah.
Now, I went on your website, and this was under the Darjeeling teas, okay? Glenburn, First Flush, and then FTGFOP1. What are we talking about?
Those mysterious letters after a tea's
right.
name. Well, when people ask me what TGFOP stands for,
right.
I say too good for ordinary people. And FTGFOP is far too good for ordinary people. And SFTGFOP, seriously far too
good
for ordinary people.
Why do I think that maybe the tea graders in other countries maybe don't have the same reference of language?
You're right there. What those letters actually are is part of the international grading system for tea leaves themselves, used by the industry, by tea testers, by growers, by auction houses. It doesn't tell you how good a tea is or how good a tea will be in the cup at all.
Uh-huh.
It is a physical description of the leaf itself. That's all it is. It has
so...
nothing to do with the quality of the leaf. It's a physical description of the leaf. And the best way to get a handle on that is to go to the base, to the root of that all those letters. And that's the OP letter. And it stands for orange peckle. And all orange peckle means has nothing to do with oranges, has nothing to do with quality. It means the leaf about an inch and a quarter long. That's it.
All right. Okay.
And this is an example of an orange peckle leaf. These are dried leaves. Inch and quarter off the plant. So when it's a fresh green leaf, these all would have been about an inch and a quarter long.
Okay.
And it could be a tea from South Carolina. It could be a tea from the Himalayas. It could be a great tea. It could be a lousy tea. All it means is a tea an inch and a quarter long.
Okay. Take me into the next step then.
Well, the next step up is usually talking about an FOP tea. And that refers to having a leaf that's a little bit more open and a little bit more flowery. And you can see some golden leaves starting to come into this
example here. Oh, yeah,
Then you would go to a TGFOP, and it doesn't mean too good for ordinary people. It means tippy, golden, flowery orange peckle.
Oh, I like it. It's very poetic.
And it refers to the fact that there's a lot of tip leaf, the very tip of the tea plant, the unformed leaf, if you will, the one that still looks like a shoot. And that'll come out a little bit lighter after its process, either a golden or a silvery color.
Now, if you could see what I'm seeing right now, I've got these two dark teas. And now this latest one is a lot of light brown pieces. And even the darker brown isn't quite as dark,
exactly,
it seems, as the others.
And this would be an FTGFOP tea. Stands for fine, tippy, golden, flowery, orange peckle. And you can see, number one, the leaf is really consistent from one leaf to the next. And a little silvery touch to the leaves.
Okay. But, you know, a question. If this doesn't have anything to do with the quality of the tea, why do we care?
Because when people are bidding on a tea at auction, they're wondering about what grade that tea is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they're bidding on, is the physical appearance of the tea itself. The short story of this is, if a tea has a lot of letters behind its name, chances are it's going to be a lot more expensive, and there's some possibility it's going to be a lot better tea, but it's not a guarantee. The proof is in the cup after you've made the tea.
Mm-hmm. So this is one of the, two or three main guidelines in judging a tea initially?
The first part of judging a tea is judging the appearance of the leaf itself. Because typically, if a tea isn't well made, it's not going to brew up well.
Okay, so we've gone to FTGFOP, right?
Yes.
Something
like that.
Yeah, all right.
Well, that actually illustrates a good point. At some point, they just start throwing on extra letters, and I consider it poetic license. I look up to a tea with a grade of about TGFOP,
right,
and that's well respected in the industry. After that, they start tacking on extra letters, and I think it's mostly hyperbole. But one other thing to keep in mind is the grading system goes the other direction, too, from OP. It goes down. The next grade down is what's called a BOP. And a BOP
is broken?
Exactly. Broken pieces of leaf. So it's broken orange peckle. And you can see that one there.
Oh, yeah.
Smaller pieces.
Right, right.
This is where some of the great bargains in teas are in the BOPs.
Oh.
Or in this case, a TGF BOP. And you can see all the gold pieces in there.
Wow.
It has tremendous flavor and nuances of complexity in there. It'll brew faster because it's a little bit...
It's broken down.
It'll brew faster. It's always less expensive. And some tremendous bargains in the BOPs. And people kind of give them short shrift, and they shouldn't.
All right. So if I see the word B, I think that's the easiest thing for me to remember. If I see the word B in that whole long list, I know I may be looking upon a real bargain and something that may have really nice quality.
Absolutely.
Dynamite. Okay, that I can remember.
The other thing is, remember, the proof is in the cup, not in the dry leaf or the label.
Okay. Hey, Phil, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Lynn.
Bill Waddington is the creator of the Tea Source Shops in Minnesota. Now, to find a recipe for tea time, be sure to check out our website, SplendidTable.org. So much essential, life-changing information is there. Our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, our podcasts, Where to Eat, and information on our book, How to Eat Supper. Also at SplendidTable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Coming up, the foods of Senegal, New York's new go-to Italian joints, and cooking with alternative energy. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Africa has long been a missing piece in the studies of how each part of our planet eats. We know of the need, but you can't have an entire continent that diverse without the growth of distinctive food traditions, and we're clueless about them. You know, I welcome any book on Africa, but there's a recent standout. It's called Yolele, Recipes from the Heart of Senegal. This is West Africa. Senegal sits on the Atlantic coast below Morocco and above Guinea. Author and chef Pierre Cham was raised there, and after cooking in many an upscale restaurant in Europe and America, he has come home to his people's food. His Senegalese restaurant, Le Grand Dakar, is in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Pierre, welcome.
Thank you.
Pierre, what does the title of the book mean?
Yolele is a Fulani word for let the good times roll.
Just like in New Orleans.
Exactly, just like in New Orleans. It's a lot in common with New Orleans and Senegal, as you'd find out when you get the book.
The book is so visually beautiful, and the photographs are, they're not the typical kind of photographs you see in a food book. How did these come about?
Well, I wanted to have a very, very good friend of mine, Adam Bartos, who's an excellent photographer, and he's not a food photographer. I knew his vision of the Senegalese culture and my family, because that's a personal book. So it was very important for me to have a special photographer for that, and Adam was just the perfect one.
There are so many portraits of these very striking women. So this is your family?
This is my family. All the women that you see in the pictures are cousins, distant relatives, aunts, grandmothers. And I wanted this book to be a tribute to the women of Senegal, the women of Africa by extension, because they are the ones who actually cook. In Senegal, men don't really cook. And I've learned my craft through just spending time with them. And then when I decided to write the book, I went back and spent more time just learning, and they were so, so giving.
What kind of food did you grow up with?
I grew up with both traditional Senegalese cuisine and the influences of the French colonial, of course. So French cuisine as well was a big part of my upbringing, because I was born in Dakar, which is a very cosmopolitan city.
Uh-huh.
There's a Portuguese influence in the south where my family is from, so I had that as well. And, of course, the Vietnamese influence, which came recently in Senegal in the 70s with the refugees that came from Indochine with the French colonial. So that was also a strong influence, because my godfather, my uncle, happens to be from there. And he's an excellent cook and the only man I knew cooking at the time.
Oh, really?
Yes, indeed.
What you said something at one point about that when the French essentially were controlling Senegal, many of the traditional foods disappeared. Are they coming back now?
Oh, yes. We're experimenting right now a serious comeback of the culinary traditions of Senegal, which is great, I think, not only for economical reasons, because it's locally grown products, like the grains that we have. It's also very healthy, and it's delicious. That's what I wanted to also introduce to this book, because there is a wealth of recipes that we can bring to the the world of cuisine.
So what? Give me some details, some specific dishes.
Well, I would say the millet couscous, the cherry, we call it. It's something very similar to the Moroccan.
Uh-huh.
It's the only difference is the grain. We use millet and they use wheat. Ours is gluten-free. Ours has a more of an earthy flavor to it.
Mm-hmm.
And our millet is black grain, black millet, as opposed to some of the lighter millet that you see in the health food stores here. And beside that, it comes with beans and dates. It's very, very dense with the sauce that comes with it. And the sauce could be based with peanuts, or it's just a simple tomato-based sauce like the Moroccan do it. And the meat that you would have in it would vary from a lot of fish, because we have a very rich seashore, or meat, or lamb. Lamb is very common because of, I guess, the Muslim influence. Senegal is a 90% Muslim country. It's also a very tolerant country, because you have also a tiny Christian minority, but they're also a big part of the society. We exchange food, for instance, for certain holidays. The Christian brings certain foods to the Muslims, and the Muslim holidays, they do the same thing, bringing food to the Christians, and that brings a certain tolerance, I guess.
You know, one of the things I think that's difficult for we Americans when we look at something like an African cookbook is that we think of Africa as being a place of such need.
That's right. That's right.
And I'm just wondering, have we greatly misunderstood Africa?
I think so. I think it started to come to me gradually as I was I lived in New York for almost 20 years, worked in restaurants for almost 20 years, and I realized how much we could contribute. There was so much things that I've known in Africa, ingredients that are not known here, and that was so, I mean, not only delicious, but good for you too. And I wanted to introduce those ingredients. I wanted to also show that Africa is a continent that will really contribute to solve world hunger rather than being the one that needs help. Actually, Africa could bring that lushness, that wealth of ingredients to the world table. And that's really what Africa has to offer.
Pierre, is there a particular ingredient you would want us to seek out that would give us an experience of what the foods of Senegal can be?
Actually, if there's one ingredient, I would say it's fonio. Fonio is a tiny little grain that's been growing in Africa for thousands of years. It grows throughout the sub-Saharan coast, and we call it the seed of the universe. And that's for many reasons.
That's pretty profound.
Yes, it is. It's one of the fastest growing and maturing grain that exists because it grows and matures within 2 months. And it grows in the harshest of conditions as well. And the size of it too is one of the tiniest grain that you could even imagine. It's like as tiny as a grain of sand. But it's also easy to cook. We have a saying, fonio never embarrasses the cook because it's just so easy to cook. I mean, just simply steam it, boil it, and it can go in a salad, it can go in a stew, it can go in just as a side dish instead of rice or the grain.
How is it spelled? How is it spelled?
F-O-N-I-O, fonio.
Fonio.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to try this.
You must try it. It's really, you can find it now in African markets. But I think it's going to start to come more and more because people are manufacturing it. And in Europe, too, it's starting to be known because it really is a miracle grain.
Thank you so much, Pierre.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Pierre Tcham is author of Yaleli, Recipes from the Heart of Senegal. We have got to try that grain fonio. Now, you can get information on where to find it and Pierre's recipe for sesame fonio on the website, splendidtable.org. Kalameko is first on my list when I want to know where to eat in New York City. He knows the restaurant scene as a chef and from his TV and radio shows. Mike, welcome back.
Always great. A pleasure. Hello, Lynn.
I'd like to talk about what's happened to Southern Italian restaurants over the past couple of years.
You know, it's near and dear to my heart. Most of the Italians that came to America between the 1880s and, say, 1920, which was that big wave of immigrants, were from the South, because the South, to this day, is still nearly a century behind the rest of the country. It's still relatively poor and still very agrarian. So Campania was a big region. Of course, Naples is the heart of that. So a lot of what Americans consider Italian cooking, you know, chicken parmigiana and lasagna done a certain style and shrimp scampi. A lot of these dishes don't really exist in Italy, but they're this sort of Neapolitan American amalgam because when they came, they didn't find, you know, the immigrants that came didn't find a lot of the ingredients they were used to. Mm-hmm. So there was no fresh oregano, so they used dried oregano. They couldn't find certain types of cheese, so they used other cheeses. We were a country that has a lot of meat, so meat became front and center, where of course, truthfully, in southern Italy, they don't have a lot of meat. You don't see much beef or veal. You see a lot of fish. But so for a long time, there was this wonderful cuisine that was Italian-American cooking that was basically all Southern Italian cooking, but it didn't really reflect what was going on in Italy. And I think if you traveled in Italy, you'd go there and say, wait a second, this is nothing like the food that they're serving, yeah, you know, down the street, or even the places I'm eating at in New York that are wonderful. You know, those old school places like Patsy's that are still growing strong, but it's a food that's become American Italian food. So in the last couple of years, some real young chefs, some of them are Italian American origin, others not, have traveled around in Italy. A couple of them have worked extensively in Italy and they've come back. And I think for the first time, perhaps ever, we've got really, really great, authentic, regional Southern Italian cooking taking place. And I'll walk you through three of them.
Oh, great. Okay.
The most recent opening was a restaurant called Convivio. This used to be L'Impero. It's in Tudor City, which is this huge housing development all the way east on 42nd Street, almost by the East River.
Right.
It's great. It's almost like Peter Cooper meets Forest Hills Gardens. It's these beautiful old buildings,
yeah,
and they're neat. And it was built a long time ago. And it used to be hotels and single room occupancy. And now it's all co-ops and condos right by the UN. But L'Impero is great. The chef's Michael White, who is a big, big strapping Midwesterner, Scandinavian background, worked in Italy for years at San Domenico, traveled around Italy, met his wife there, and he's doing some of the best Southern Italian regional cooking I've ever had outside of Southern Italy. Homemade pastas, not just egg pastas.
Wow.
But he also has that pasta that's just durum wheat and hot water that's worked together that's so chewy.
Yeah.
Seven or eight pastas on the menu, all house-made, all fresh. Really stunning, great appetizers. Couscous, which of course you don't think of as Italian, but it's very Sicilian.
Oh, yes, very much so.
It's just wonderful. His partner in that business, they have another restaurant called Alto, which is Northern Italian cooking, like Alto Adige.
Uh-huh.
But his other partner is Chris Cannon, who's a great wine guy. It's just wonderful. It's moderately priced, and it's gonna blow him out of the water once all the reviewers hit it, and they've already started. Opened just before that on 14th Street, downtown, just by the Meatpacking District, is a place called Scarpetta. Chef is Scott Conant. He's half Italian, and he was actually the original chef at Alto and L'Impero. He left to do something in the Hamptons and came back and just opened up this place, this past spring, and I was there this summer a couple of times, and he just gets it right. He's another one of these guys that gets pasta, gets Italian cooking, a super pasta section of the menu, roast goat, which is something you just don't normally see in Italian menus.
Yeah, exactly.
He's got it, and it's wonderful, and it's simple. He does a beautiful osso buco, polenta with wild mushrooms and truffles. Just got 3 stars from Frank Bruni from the New York Times a couple of months ago. Not easy to do. Critically acclaimed, wonderful place. And the last one, which was opened about a year ago, is right, it's in Midtown. It's an area you don't usually think of doing great, great restaurants. And it's in that real kind of touristy section of town, 7th Avenue between 50th and 51st, in the Michelangelo Hotel. It's called Insieme. I-N-I-S-I-E-M-E.
Meaning together, right?
Together.
Yeah.
And what it was originally was a sort of old style and new style mixed. Now it's kind of more new style because I think they felt pinned into a corner. But Insieme is just wonderful. Again, these guys are buying ingredients fresh every day, getting a lot of Italian-sourced ingredients. He's got a little thing called a torco, which is, there's only a couple of these in the city. It's an Italian pasta maker that grinds these really hard water doughs.
Yeah.
And you need two guys.
Yeah.
One sits underneath the table on a milk crate and cuts the dough, and the other cranks it from above, and this pasta is really chewy. It really holds its salt. So all three of these places, again, that list was Convivio, which is in Tudor City,
right,
Scarpetta on 14th Street, and Insieme in Midtown are just stunners.
Hey, Mike, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Mike Colomeco is host of PBS 13's Colomeco's Food Show. Now, I've got an iconic dish of the Campania region of southern Italy. The recipe for Nonna's, as in grandma's, home-style lasagna is on the website, splendidtable.org. Bill Scheller says that we can plant 2 feet in every carbon footprint. To clarify, he means that we can drive our cars and at the same time cook dinner. All we have to do is follow his instructions. Now, these gems of brilliance show up in the latest update of Bill's book, Manifold Destiny, The Guide to Cooking on Your Car Engine. Bill, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. Nice to be back.
Now, this is not just satire, right? I mean, this is the real deal.
Well, it manages to be both. You can read and enjoy the book even if you never plan to cook on your car engine, but all of the recipes actually do work.
Now, you and your co-author, was it Chris Maynard? How did this start? I mean, when did the idea come?
Well, it kind of popped into our heads one day when we were driving on a long trip and had something that we really would rather have warm than cold. It was a nice Montreal smoked meat. So we started off small with simply heating up something. And then later on, we graduated to cooking from scratch.
Well, give me an idea of the range of stuff that you can do on your car engine.
Well, as a rule, you want to do things that aren't too heavy with liquid, and you don't like to do things with bones because they take too long.
Uh-huh.
Things from the fillet and cutlet food groups are good. And you don't want to do potatoes. You don't want to do anything that involves baking. We had a disastrous time once trying to bake apples. Took forever. But generally, things like fish fillets, veal cutlets, pork tenderloins are one of the more showpiece dishes that we've come up with.
So can you give us some of the basics? Like what equipment do you need?
Well, the most important thing is aluminum foil. We can't overstress that. We wrap everything three times in aluminum foil. Although since we first wrote the book, they've come out with heavy-duty aluminum foil, and that you can get away with wrapping twice in. And now they have this wonderful non-stick aluminum foil, so we're keeping up with the foil technology as each edition goes to press. But that's your most important tool. Once it's triple-wrapped and you find a spot in the engine that represents a compromise between heat and security, you're on your way.
These are the things they don't tell you on the TV cooking shows. Where is the best spot on most engines?
Well, they don't tell you these in the car ads either, but there is no one best spot. As I say, you want to compromise between heat and security. You don't want to find a really good hot spot where things will bounce off in the road.
Yeah,
or a spot that's very secure that'll never get hot enough. The book is titled Manifold Destiny, not just for the sake of the pun, but because the exhaust manifold is the hottest spot on a car engine. It's getting a little more difficult to find as they refine engine design, but you can usually find little nooks and crannies where you can tuck things in that even if you have to turn it over halfway through your trip, you'll manage to cook.
For serious car cookers, are there cars to avoid?
Well, generally we found that the older the car, the better. The more modern cars, the engines are starting to look like European vacuum cleaners, very sleek and modular and plastic sheathing over the top. The absolute worst are the cars made by Porsche. Porsche doesn't want you to go near the engine. Only Porsche certified mechanics can do that.
Uh-huh.
And even though you've paid your $80,000, you've got no business going in there to do anything other than change the oil, let alone cook. So you can't even get at the engine on a Porsche. But some of the older cars have these big open spaces, and you can tuck things along the top of the valve covers and hold them in place with spark plug wires. You can cook just about anything on a big old American V8.
Any specific recipes that kids are going to really like? Because I'm thinking you're on a long road trip and you always hear, I'm hungry. And if you could just stop and pull something off the engine, that would be great.
Well, I think kids would like our Cuban sandwich here, the Media Noche, which we've renamed the Median Noche because you pull over onto the median to eat it. It's sort of like a panini, and it just involves Cuban bread, or if you don't have that, a baguette, some ham, roast pork, Swiss cheese, and pickles. This is the kind of recipe that really calls for cooking on the top of a cast aluminum fuel injection housing, very often right up on top of the engine, and you hold it in place by pressing down rolled up wads of aluminum foil on top of it. And the hood holds it in place. We may be getting more out of a gallon of gas, but we're definitely using a lot of foil.
Bill, thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Lynn. It's been fun.
Bill Scheller is co-author of Manifold Destiny, The Guide to Cooking on Your Car Engine. Try Bill's Prius Pork the next time that you're looking at a 60-mile drive. The recipe's on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what is the trick to upping a cow's milk production? Well, we're going to be back in a moment with that answer, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. We're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. And the question was, what is the trick to upping a cow's milk production? Call her by name. Treat her as part of the family, and she will give you a lot more milk. And this isn't sentimental claptrap. There is new science to prove it. The UK did a study with some 500 dairy farmers. They discovered that cows addressed by name gave an average of 454 more pints of milk a year. Well, two things were found. First, cows are like us. Make them feel special and they'll knock themselves out for you. Second, dairy farmers knew all along what scientists had to dig for. It turns out British dairy farmers already knew that their cows were intelligent, sensitive, and emotional creatures who responded well when appreciated for their individuality. One thing you do not want to do with a cow is treat her as merely one of the herd. Sound familiar?
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? Well, you should call me. When? Well, I get all my messages. I never got any from you.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Let's see, who is calling? We have got Christine on the line from San Antonio. Christine, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome.
I am going to be getting married in November.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I have been dying to get your advice on something. My dad has some good old boyfriends who travel all over Texas entering barbecue contests. And in doing so, they have converted a John Deere tractor into a barbecue pit. And they've actually shown me a picture. It's fantastic.
I think so, I know what's coming.
Well, they have offered to cook for my wedding. And when my dad first told me about it, I was a little bit embarrassed. And I thought, my goodness, how could he think that I would want a John Deere tractor at my wedding? But, you know, the more I think about it and I start budgeting and planning, it would actually be really fun, I think.
Well, look, you're a Texan, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And this is a great tradition in your state,
right? It is.
And first of all, I would just love to see it right outside the church waiting for everybody, you know. So what is the question then?
Well, you know, since we're going to be so close to Christmas and Thanksgiving, I've always wanted to do like a slice of turkey with some stuffing rolled up and dressing, but I don't want to overdo the turkey. So what I'm thinking about doing is some grilled chicken breast with some grilled vegetables. I just don't know which way to go with the vegetables and what exactly I do with it all once I pull it off the grill.
Well, is this going to be a buffet or is it going to be a sit-down thing?
Probably buffet.
Okay, so this is one of the rules with buffet. You have to be able to eat it with one fork.
Okay.
No knives or whatever, because nobody's going to be sitting on their lap sawing away. So either it's something that's totally finger easy to, you know, you can eat with your fingers, mm-hmm. or it's something you can eat with a fork. I mean, you could do the chicken thing. I mean, one thing that might be interesting to do would be to marinate. First of all, take chicken breasts, pound them out. Okay. So they're like a big fillet.
Okay.
Boneless, skinless chicken breast. Pound them out. Marinate them overnight in something interesting. I mean, it could be something like, I don't know, lime juice, fresh ginger, garlic, a little bit of honey. Roll them up with a filling, like a stuffing of some kind, you know, a cornbread nut fruit stuffing, and literally roll them up like a jelly roll.
Okay.
And if they were then just stuck with toothpicks, they could go on that grill. They could be brushed with their marinade. And then to serve them, they would just be thin, you know, sliced. So you'd be getting these spirals.
Okay.
You see, and you could just stick your fork in or eat it with your fingers. The other thing is you could do the same thing with the chicken breasts and cut them in strips.
Okay.
And then they're grilled and they could be done in a great barbecue sauce. And with that, you could also do things like long wedges of sweet potatoes that you've rolled in Indian spices and oil so that they'll get nice and crusty and spicy tasting. Again, I'm stepping a little away from the traditional barbecue flavors only because, you know, maybe you don't want that. If you wanted that traditional barbecue sauce and all those great traditions, you know, you live in a place where people would love that as well.
Mm-hmm.
You could have grilled red onion, which would be great. I mean, it could really be very pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could even do things like grilled Parkhook cauliflower.
Oh. Okay.
And you could put these in any kind of combination of seasonings that you want. The only thing to be a little cautious of is anything that's sugary is going to brown quickly. So you want to always, the things that are in anything sweet, you want to have them be things that do cook quickly.
Excellent.
So think, you know, flip through some cookbooks and look at marinades. Go on our website, you know, look at some of the dishes. Ignore the dish, but look at what the marinade or the flavoring is. And
okay.
Know that that can go on almost anything your budget and your taste, you know, likes the idea of.
Perfect.
Okay.
Thank you so much. That helps
a lot. And have a blast.
I'll send you some pictures when we're done.
Oh, please do. Please do.
I will.
Hey, you take care, girl.
Thank you. You too.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Call
us, 800-537-5252. We've got Joe on the line from Minneapolis. Joe, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I am really wanting to make a romantic dinner for me and my girlfriend of 4 years, and I thought maybe you'd have a cool recipe for that.
Ooh. Well, what does she like to eat?
We're both really into a lot of different stuff, but I know what she doesn't like, which might help you more. She's not really into beef. If that makes any difference.
No, that makes a big difference. I mean, is she someone who would really love something that focuses on grains and, you know, great veggies or an Asian kind of theme?
Oh, sure.
Okay. You know what might be fun to do? Does she love soup?
Do you like soup, Mel? She likes soup. She loves soup, she said.
Well, you know, one of the things you could do is do a fast version of that great Vietnamese soup called pho. It's spelled P-H-O.
Okay.
Yeah. I love it because you're eating it with chopsticks and a spoon and a kind of slurpy, and it's a meal in itself. And then you could precede it with spring rolls, which you could buy if you wished, or you could make, but that's finger food as well. This is what I think a romantic dinner should be. It should be stuff that you can eat with your fingers, stuff that doesn't leave you feeling like, you know, you're moaning and groaning because you've had so much rich food.
Yeah,
and yet you've had a lot of fun, and stuff you have to take time to eat.
Okay.
Yeah, because that's part of the fun of it. So here's the deal. With pho, the broth is the big thing. Now, this is the Vietnamese beef broth soup that will have a little bit of meat in it, a lot of vegetables, and rice noodles.
Okay.
And on the table, you then have something called a table salad, which will be leaves of greens, some bean sprouts, and then some fresh basil or fresh coriander, and maybe some sliced chilies. Okay, so you just make a beautiful platter of that, and that goes on the table. And then what you do is you take a chopped up onion, and you take some crushed garlic cloves, okay? And you take some star anise, which you can find now in co-ops and supermarkets, all right?
Okay.
And a cinnamon stick. And you put that on a sheet of foil, and you put it under the broiler for a little while until you can smell everything. That goes into a pot. You add a little white wine. You add some canned chicken broth, about 3 or 4 cans of chicken broth, okay, and about a teaspoon of Thai fish sauce. Again, all of this is in the supermarket. And you let that simmer for maybe 15, 20 minutes. And then with a slotted spoon, pull out everything that's solid. Because
okay.
Now you've got a nice basic broth. You take rice noodles. You drop them in there. You chop up some bok choy or plain old, you know, cabbage, some thin sliced onion. You drop that in. You give it about 5 minutes because you want it to be crunchy. Okay? You put that into big bowls. You thin slice either, you could do chicken breast. You could do even lamb, even though it's not traditional. You could do lamb. She's not into beef. This is why I'm avoiding the beef broth part. I'm doing a chicken version. Or you could do seafood. But the hot broth cooks whatever you put in. So you slice it super thin. And then the idea is that each one of you uses your table salad to flavor that dish, however you want. It's a very easy dish. You could do the broth well ahead. If you can give it an hour of simmering, all the better. But if you can't, don't worry about it. And then you would start with some nice light spring rolls and some good dipping sauce, and you will have a blast. And then I would have something fabulous and chocolatey for dessert.
We love chocolate. Anything with chocolate is great.
Well, I mean, would she enjoy this, do you think?
Yeah, I definitely think so. We like a lot of Vietnamese food, and we have a few favorite restaurants around MCAD where we go to school. So,
well, you're a great guy, and I think you guys will have a good time.
Yeah, thank you very much. It sounds fantastic.
Hey, you take care. Bye,
right,
Joe.
You too. Bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. Snobbery is an underestimated achievement. People work for lifetimes to become snobs. Usually without any consistent guidance, they grope around on their own. Well, food writer David Camp is out to change that with his guidebooks. The latest is the Wine Snobs Dictionary, essential for those who wish to be one or wish to survive one. David, welcome.
Delighted to be here, Lynn.
So, David, how do you bluff your way through a wine tasting? You know, you're at a party and the wine snobs are sipping away and making trenchant comments. What do you say?
Well, that's what's so handy about this book, is that it last gives you that vocabulary to, you know, deal with these cryptic, snobby people. And one of my favorite things in the book is there's a sidebar called A Bluffer's Guide to Varietal Cliché Speak. So no matter what kind of varietal, which itself is a snobby word, just means the kind of grape that dominates the wine, no matter what kind of varietal the people are drinking, you've got your little descriptor. So, like, if everyone's drinking a Sauvignon Blanc, mm-hmm. you can say, oh, it's very grassy. And if they're drinking a Barolo, you can say, oh, it's very earthy. And if they're drinking a Zinfandel, you can say, oh, quite jammy. You know, we give you the go-to adjective for all these circumstances.
Names to know. What are some of the names we should know?
Well, I think, you know, for example, if you want to know about a big cult winery or cult wine, there's Harlan Estate, H-A-R-L-A-N. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a guy named Bill Harlan who's in Napa Valley. And, you know, it's just one of these wines that there's just a frenzy for all the time. If it comes up at auction, even in hard times like now, rich people will bid, you know, like ridiculous amounts of money per case. So that's one.
Okay. What's another?
Well, you know, a lot of people need to know who are the wine snob experts. And you might have heard of a British lady named Jancis Robinson, who's actually a very friendly, unsnobby person, but wine snobs always refer to her as Jancis. You never use the last name, sort of like how a food snob would always say Julia, but never child.
Well, that, yeah, because that's the ultimate sense of snobbery. I know this person, you know, on the first name basis.
Oh, yeah, I looked it up in Jancis, and she said, you know, that sort of thing. You ever see the term on a label, Meritage, M-E-R-T-A-G-E?
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And people think it's pronounced Meritage, but it's actually an American term coined by Californian winemakers. Opus 1 is a really well-known example of a Meritage wine. It's a blended wine, not made from one grape, but of a superior quality, like a Bordeaux-style blend is in France.
Mm-hmm.
And the Californians came up with this term just to show that this is a high-end blended wine from California, and they wanted a prestigious term, but ironically, they chose a word that they thought would be easy to pronounce, Meritage, but in fact, you know, non-snobs, civilians, say Meritage, and it's the snobs who know how to say it. You say it the American way, Meritage.
Okay, you're meeting up with a wine snob. You want to say something intelligent. What should you say?
You actually want to use these very simple words, like when you're talking about wine, you don't call it wine, you call it juice, because that's like how sommeliers talk. And then when they're taking in the wine, putting their noses over the glass, you're mm-hmm. not smelling wine, you're nosing it. Yeah, let me nose some of this juice. You know, I'm getting a lot of pencil lead. I'm getting some top notes of kerosene. You know, it seems better, like the more inedible or unpotable the adjective, the better.
I see. I've actually heard someone refer to mouse droppings.
Mouse droppings?
Yes. I decided to leave it there. I didn't want to know more.
Well, for a lot of white wines, we hear the term pee-pee de chat, you know, meaning cat
pee.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's actually not considered a negative thing. And another positive descriptor for certain complex red wines is barnyard. Oh, I'm getting a lot of barnyard funk on this. And that's considered a positive quality.
All right. I know there are a lot of these expensive cult wines,
mm-hmm.
but considering the economy, are there any now cult bargains?
Yes. And you know what? My co-author, who's a sommelier, David Lynch, he and I were discussing this. We could do a whole other volume of these terms. And one that came up, it's a really good, cheap wine that I've been seeing around for like $10-$12 a bottle, but it tastes like a $40 bottle of wine. And there's debate on how to pronounce it. I would say Jumilla. It's a Spanish wine, J-U-M-I-L-L-A. But a lot of the wine snobs are calling it Jumilla. And I don't know how to say it, and that will be a big wine snob debate. But it's a Spanish municipality, a wine-producing region, and they're making these incredibly complex and good wines that you can get for $10-$12 a bottle.
Is it a red or white?
It's a red, yeah. Uh-huh. And I'm just over the moon about it. I just got a case of it, and, you know, and the case itself was like, you know, $150 or something. I was really happy.
That's 12 bottles of wine. That's not too bad.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not too bad. Yeah. Hey, David, thanks for talking with us and a great tip.
Oh, well, it's always a pleasure.
David Camp is co-author of the Wine Snobs Dictionary. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime you want. Number's 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this from Anonymous. The road to great wine is littered with beer bottles. Splendid Table is distributed by American Public Media. Now, information on everything you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Have a visit. You're going to find podcasts, newsletters, a recipe archive from our very talented and opinionated guests, and information on our book, How to Eat Supper. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin, and our managing producer is Sally Swift. Have a great week. Please join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.